Stuart Comer. I'm curator of film at Tate Modern, and I'd very much like to thank the Frieze Art Fair and the editors of Frieze Magazine for inviting me to convene this discussion. I've been to several panels in the past year, which have been very thought-provoking for me, so it's nice to be invited to be part of this series. And it's also very exciting to be able to have the opportunity to invite the three speakers sitting to my left today, all of whom have been very important and influential to me, and I think to a lot of people in this room, probably. Maybe before I introduce each of them, I'll just try to briefly outline what I hope this talk will be about. I'm already beginning to think that the title of it might be a slight misnomer, but it kind of arose out of a series of things that kind of entered into my radar over the past few months, one of which was a book by an art historian and a colleague of mine named Mark Godfrey, who's written a recent publication called Abstraction and the Holocaust. And he begins by discussing an experience he had at Documenta 11 several years ago, in which he noticed that abstraction was not really present at all in Documenta, and it was, in fact, very much about the documentary form. And then last summer at Documenta 12, I came across Hito Steirel's three computer screen monochrome piece called Red Alert. And it really got me thinking about, you know, the relationship between documentary and abstraction and maybe just the role of a certain kind of image and historically where that might be going. Subsequently, even in the past few weeks, I think I've received four or five announcements about exhibitions that address ideas around voids and emptiness or a lack of an image. So in a way, we're returning to ideas that have circulated throughout the 20th century, but around not just dematerialization, but an actual lack or an actual absence of the image. In fact, there's a new article on Hito's work in the recent issue of After All that begins, "Something is missing." So if something is missing, I mean, again, many of you will know Jacques Rancière's book, The Future of the Image, and he begins one section by claiming that the end of images is behind us. That is, a certain historical project around a certain kind of image is behind us. So basically, I'm hoping we can start to ask ourselves, you know, what is an image now? Or perhaps how has this historical shift impacted the way images circulate? It's no accident that the two artists on the panel with me both work in film. Obviously, I curate in film, but I think in the past few years, there's been a major shift in art historical practice, which is beginning to accommodate other kinds of media, and in particular, time-based media. And frankly, it's about time. And I think the role of the image within a time-based situation is obviously a potentially radically different one that we haven't fully accommodated ourselves to, but I think the three people here have really begun to think about these issues in profound ways. So to start, on my immediate left is George Baker, who's a professor at UCLA and has written brilliantly recently on a major publication on Picabia. He's working on a book on contemporary art that shares the title of an article he wrote for October, a journal for which he's an editor, called Reanimations. He's also written on the art of James Coleman, Robert Smithson, and Anthony McCall, amongst many other people. He also was teaching a course which was brought to my attention by one of his students at UCLA called Photography in the Expanded Field, which is a subject I think he's now further expanded in his recent work, and I hope he'll bring that into play in the conversation. Morgan Fisher is an artist and filmmaker from Los Angeles. We presented a survey of his films at Tate a couple of years ago, so hopefully some of you will have seen the films. I should say now it's a little bit frustrating that we won't be able to see more work from Hito and from Morgan today, but each of them will show a brief clip as they introduce their own work before we get into the conversation. But I would encourage you to avail yourself to any screenings of their work that might come your way. Morgan started producing renowned films in the late 60s and early 70s that were heavily tied to the structuralist film movement, but then continues to make both film work and installations and paintings today. Back to the idea of the monochrome, I think it's something that underlies quite a lot of his work, especially the recent installation work, and some of you might have seen an installation that was held at Art Basel in the Unlimited this June that was pretty fabulous. Hito Steirel, as I just mentioned, is a subject of two new texts in the new After All. She's also an artist and filmmaker working in Berlin. Many of you will have seen a couple of videos that she presented in the last Documenta, as well as Red Alert, which I mentioned a moment ago. She's also teaching at the Academie der Kunst, and she's also been the subject of a fantastic article by TJ Demos in a recent issue of Art Forum. So without further ado, I'd like to ask Morgan to start maybe addressing his work a bit in light of some of these issues, and then Hito will move on after that.
Thank you, Stuart. Thank you, Freeze people. I'm having a wonderful time. Now, I want to be brief because I think we'll only have fun when we can all have a conversation. So I'm going to show the first 3 minutes of a film that I finished in 2003, which is the most recent film I made. And the title is, it's a pair of parentheses. The film is silent, and it is 21 minutes long. But it could be any length, and I'll get to what that means after we take a look at it. And what I think might not be immediately clear from it's the first 2.5 minutes, or 3 minutes of the film. Yeah, 3 minutes. The film looks as if it's edited. It looks as if it's within the model of montage, and it's not. And that's very important, and I'll talk about that later after the clip. So it looks like montage. One can only assume that it has the intentionality that we associate with montage, but on the contrary, it does not have that intentionality. So, as I would say, it's a work that's constructed rather than edited, and I'll get to that afterwards. So why don't we take a look at the first 3 minutes of parentheses. The film consists entirely of a kind of shot that occurs in narrative film called an insert. They're either inserts or else shots that are close enough to being inserts that I felt I could include them. And inserts, I would say, are the most instrumentalized of all shots in a narrative fiction film. They have to be there to make something clear. So the idea is that they are totally transparent with respect to meaning. What they can't be is ambiguous or unclear. The entire point of an insert is that it makes something absolutely clear. And so they are, so to speak, and I use this word deliberately, inserts are servants. They are servants of the story. And they're there because they're necessary, because narrative films in general obey the principle of economy, and only things that need to be there are, and if an insert is there, it had to be there to make the story clear. So what I wanted to do, I wanted to de-instrumentalize inserts. And by making a film of nothing but inserts, or by taking inserts out of their stories, I would like to say, liberated the inserts from their stories. And I'll get to what that means at the very end. But now, on the matter of length, the minimum length for this film, I think, would be 4 shots. And one of the ways that I constructed Stuart's the title of this, our talk, or our symposium, is that the image has become a problem. That's maybe a way that I would paraphrase it. So the question is, if the image is now a problem, what to do about it? And one strategy is indifference. Indifference not to the image, but to the specific image. And I would say that this film represents that strategy. And this is what I mean by that. I would say that it doesn't particularly matter what the inserts are. And I can put this more polemically by saying that if someone else were to make a film of nothing but inserts, I should have mentioned this, there's a rule. There's a hidden rule that constructed the film for me. So what happens at the cuts is a matter of chance. So this is what I mean about how it doesn't fall within the convention of montage, where we assume that the cuts are intentional. that the juxtapositions at the cuts are intentional, that are so that what happens at the cuts is a matter of chance, and it doesn't particularly matter what is in the shots. The important thing to keep in mind is that whatever does happen at the cuts is not intentional, but a matter of chance. So I would say, to return to the matter of indifference, I would say that if someone were to make a film of nothing but inserts and it followed my rule, it doesn't matter what the inserts are, it's still this film. So, and the film could be any length. This film, it is 21 minutes and it's like 380 or something shots. It could be, the film could be someone else's version of this film, could be 100 minutes or a year long. It would be nice to see a film that was a year long or 100 years long. And if it followed my rule and it was inserts, it's still this film. It doesn't matter what the shots are, provided they're all members of this category. So that's the strategy of indifference, or treating the image generically with respect to its specificity as an image, but then insisting on its being a member of a category. And I'll finish by saying, I would like to claim that this film is in its way political, and not just in a loose sense, but maybe in an allegorical sense, and that is, I said that inserts are necessary, and they are, and I also said that this film liberates inserts. So I would like to think that the film raises inserts from the realm of necessity to the realm of freedom. And we all know who said that. Thank you.
Okay, Hito?
Yes, I think probably we should proceed now by ways of dialectical juxtaposition, meaning there's going to be a radical cut now, because whatever I'm going to show now is going to look very different, at least at the surface, but I believe there are some common issues at hand. I would like to show you a clip from a film of mine called November, which, well, I'm going to talk about that later. I made it in 2004. It's 25 minutes long. And essentially, Morgan said that he didn't montage his film. He constructed it. Essentially, I think this film is rather intercepted or received. What is it about? It's about an event which remains unrepresented, about the death of a former friend of mine, her violent death as a Kurdish freedom fighter in Turkey. She used to be my best friend when I was 17. We made some Super 8 films together. You're going to see some clips of that in the film as well. And later on, she went underground 15 years later and was killed during a firefight with the Turkish army. And the film tries to juxtapose, or does juxtapose, two completely different sets of imagery. For once, the Super 8 films we did in our youth, which are essentially inspired by B-movies, by trash culture, by pop culture, and the like. And the imagery which emerged of her after her death, when she was revered as a martyr of the Kurdish cause, and obviously there are posters, you know, which portray her in the pose of the martyr. Essentially, why did I say that it's rather about intercepting images than really montaging them or finding them or arranging them? I think the whole film is made of pictures which are circulating in the public realm in a certain way or another. These are pictures which can be found online in a very degraded state, online images which are sort of flowing around the world in rather unofficial channels. And in this way, I think this video consists of intercepted images of various versions of my friend. Maybe we can see the first 3 minutes of the film.
Okay.
My best friend when I was 17 was a girl called Andrea Wolf. In 1998, she was shot as a Kurdish terrorist. This is my first film. It's that she does. This is me. What's wrong from life? She's running. This is Andrea. Child of the night. In her life, it's impossible to reconstruct the story of the film. Only the fighting scenes were shot, showing a gang of three girls trying to clumsily beat up every male they can get their hands on. The film is silent because the only spools we could steal had no sound. And Andrea was its charismatic, strong and beautiful center. The last time I have seen Andrea was 2 years before she went underground, 5 years before she was executed in Kurdistan.
They took her prisoner. One could hear her voice. The voice of Comrade Ronayi was full of fear. She screamed. First her voice fell silent, then the one of Comrade Yad. Then Comrade Ronayi was killed.
There are strange coincidences with the material we shot almost 15 years earlier, back in Bavaria, where we grew up. In the film, we are constantly fighting, probably for justice, and the ethic code of the film is that only villains use weapons, and the good guys and girls use their bare hands for fighting. Only in this film it is I who gets shot, and Andrea survives. She picks up the weapon, executes the villain, and rides off into the sunset on a motorbike.
Okay, well, that wasn't exactly the point where I wanted to cut it off, but I think you might get the idea. The next thing which is edited into the movie are her posters where she's pictured as a martyr of the Kurdish cause. And they obviously look very much different, although, let's say, the way in which I got hold of these pictures is not very much different from the way in which I was able to access the other picture. It's all this sort of, let's say, low-quality, low-resolution images which are sort of circulating. And I think one point where there might be some common ground between mine and Morgan's film is that there are weapons in both of these films. But I think also I was very interested in hearing him talk about inserts being servants of, you know, dominant film narration, because I think that in many ways one could describe the low-resolution images which are navigating, you know, through all these online channels in a very similar way. They are not servants, but in a hierarchy of images which is predicated on resolution, they tend to occupy the lowest rank of the ladder. They are not proletarians, they are the lumpen proletarians of the world of images. And this is why I'm really interested in this kind of images. How do you access them? How are they circulating? Which sort of constituencies are they constructing while being circulated? There's another point why I think that these images are specifically interesting. These images, because they are so degraded They are like 72 DPI images, you know, just consisting of a few pixels in extreme cases. These pictures tend towards abstraction. They are really becoming more and more abstract, and obviously this ties in with a lot of digital image or digital media production of the last 20 years. Video images tended to become more and more blurry, more and more shaky, while, you know, pretending to get closer and closer to reality. We are sort of bombarded by images from cell phone cameras, you know, proclaim a certain urgency, you know. They pretend to be real close to the event, to reality, to be reality as such, to portray it as such. But on the other hand, they are completely abstract. There isn't anything left to see on these pictures. And that's a very interesting paradox for me. The more real this type of documentary media images get, the less there is left to see on them. But I think this also points at a very interesting relationship between the abstract and concretion, because this abstraction of the degraded media images we see reveals something very concrete indeed, and this is the condition of their production. They reveal, so to speak, the whole visual diagram of the period. They speak of a period in which intransparency, opacity, and uncertainty have become the governing principles of image production. And by thinking through, let's say, this relationship of the abstract and the concrete, it has become very interesting for me to think through documentary image production in terms of abstraction. Very concrete documentary images can be completely abstract, you know, when it comes to their content, and very abstract documentary images can be very concrete when it comes to their conditions of production and the conditions of visibility into which they are embedded.
Yeah. So, George and Morgan, you can come back. Oh.
I don't have a film. So, I had a mic. I had to take this off because I needed to see those works.
Can you hear me? Yes. I don't have a film, but I have a book, Anthony. In trying to think what I might present, I thought to just present some of the ideas that I've been working through in some recent texts would be useful, and to hear Anthony talk just now about the liberation of a class of images that he's characterized as a kind of servant class, this kind of what I would call autonomization of form, and to hear Hito just talk about a lumpenproletariat class of images. Actually, this is exactly what I wanted to present to you very, very briefly. I wanted to return to a book that I'm assuming almost no one has read, that I wrote in 2003, and I apologize to the artist about whom I wrote it, because it's not his fault that no one's read my text, Gerard Byrne, a book in 2003 associated with an exhibition he had in Frankfurt. I wanted to return to this book because it's as I understood the brief for today, it's the one text where I've dealt most explicitly with questions of abstraction in contemporary art, and I chose to deal with them through ideas coming out of economic concerns, social historical Marxist concerns, really. And since this is my first time at an art fair, I thought it would be good to talk about capital and economics as they relate to questions of abstraction and representation in images today. At any rate, in my in this short book that I wrote, it starts with an epigraph that I guess I could read to you because we're at an art fair. And the epigraph's from Bertolt Brecht, which is an artist that I found myself returning to. The debates between Brecht and Lukács over the question of realism at the moment of high modernism, I think, are crucial to reconnect to in the current debates that we're having about images today. At any rate, it was the artist's Gerard Byrne's own concern with Brecht and some of his work that brought me back to these debates at first. And my epigraph to the text that I will go on to write just quotes Brecht saying, "Here again, the road leads over capitalism's dead body. But here again, this road is a good one." Now, coming to the art fair today and the economic moment that we're inhabiting today, this quote starts to sound a little bit different to me than when I wrote it, copied it 5 years ago. But I'll get to that in just a moment. I have some images, actually, so I could put them up. And I'm going to basically show them illustratively and not talk about them in any great detail. What I wound up trying to think about in this text, I won't go through all of it, but I wanted to return to the Brecht-Lukács debates from the 20s on realism, because Brecht takes a position at that point vis-a-vis realism that it's not about actually representation or figuration, that it's not about the ability of the image to speak to what we used to call a totality, to represent either symptomatically or otherwise the total social situation in which we find ourselves, historically speaking. Brecht's position was somewhat different, and I just want to quote again from Brecht, a little bit less of a juicy quote than stepping on capitalism's dead body and working through the corpse, which I think is a fantastic metaphor. Realism, one attempt of Brecht's, I'm quoting him now, "realist means laying bare society's causal network, showing up the dominant viewpoint as the viewpoint of the dominators, writing from the standpoint of the class which has prepared the broadest solutions for the most pressing problems afflicting human society, emphasizing the dynamics of development, concrete, so as to encourage abstraction." These are lists of things that he says defines his position on realism. And now, what I would go on to attempt in the face of the practice I'm showing you, a still and I guess a production photo, it would be called, from Gerard Byrne's work, "Why It's Time for Imperial Again, 1998-2002. Is it "Why It's Time for Imperial Again"? Jared? Yeah, thank you. what I tried to work through were ways in which, in fact, in a project of a photographer and filmmaker in the contemporary moment, who for the most part is dealing with concerns of rethinking narrative forms, who seems to be dealing with, in his photographic work, genres and modes of what we would have called documentary in the past. Nevertheless, we're dealing with an artist who is deeply concerned with what we would call abstraction. And what I was trying to think through was if, like Brecht's position on realism was articulated in one moment of capitalism, monopoly capitalism, industrial capitalism, we would have to update these debates today if we were going to really think about realism again today in terms of the structures of capital today. I rely very heavily in this text on Frederick Jameson's notions of finance capital. And ultimately, what I try to think through as a project in this text, to try to just get down to the very point of this project for me, was in a moment of financial speculation, at the moment that I was writing this in 2003, a mode of abstraction that now separates not just objects from their context, say, in the moment of the early 20th century, but separates capital from objects altogether. So sheer number, sheer sort of quantification, profits made from profits as opposed to profits made from products. In a moment of financial speculation, is there a cultural version of these procedures? Is there something we could call cultural speculation as opposed to financial speculation? And so, like Brecht trying to work through capitalism's dead body, is there a way in which contemporary artists using images are, in fact, in the process of their use of images, not what they represent, but how they use the images themselves, working through a kind of mode like financial speculation or in some mediated relationship to financial speculation? Now, that was 2003, and so could I have the next image? What reading Brecht's epigraph, the epigraph I chose from Brecht for this text again today, made me think, of course, if one's going to think about finance capital and debates around images today, if one's going to think about cultural speculation as a kind of advanced artistic project in the present, as opposed to financial speculation. I mean, financial speculation comes with the specter of the crash, and we are now no longer confronting the specter. So a question for me that began, that is now, in a sense, something I'm trying to work through in some of my current projects and in projects I've written recently, without articulating it as vehemently as I try in this text, is what would be the sort of aesthetic conditions of a economic, social, historical moment of the crash? Not just the financial crash, the art market crash, I guess, hasn't happened yet. Maybe you could tell me more, people who come to the fair. Maybe it will not happen, we don't know. But a moment now, could we think of something like an aesthetic crash? What would this mean? One body of work that I've written about, the work of Paul Chan for the exhibition that was at the Serpentine last year, tries to deal with a specific body of work by an artist where an artist begins to, in a certain sense, I guess one way of describing this project for me, would begins to take apart the images and the languages of his own previous work. So the project, The Seven Lights, one image from which I'm showing you here, one of the things at least that the artist Paul Chan achieves in this project is an intense mode of the citation of his previous images from previous films projections he's made, and he seems to break those images apart, quoting his own work and undoing the narrative and other forms in which he had invested his project earlier. So we see an artist, in some sense, self-destructing his own previously built-up aesthetic language, breaking it down, fragmenting it into pieces. So this modality of destruction of one's own image language, its self-implosion, this has become very interesting for me to think as I try to with the text on Jared Byrne in relationship to a social historical episteme that we seem to be existing in at the moment. And can I have the next image? Very, very differently than that, though, we have, showing you an image from Zoe Leonard's project Analog, a very different relationship that's maybe taken off, not so much, I think, a kind of process of a procedure of self-destruction, but a process of dealing with emptiness as it actually exists in the social historical fabric and bringing that in the image in a way in which the emptiness becomes completely transformed. I wanted to remember before I shut up and stop, and we can open to discussion. Aside from Brecht, the other major voice in this book from 2003 that I wrote is Walter Benjamin, Brecht's sort of interlocutor at that moment in those debates about realism and abstraction. So let me just stop myself for a moment and insert, based on vis-a-vis what Anthony and Hito were saying, this is my version of a kind of lumpen proletariat image. And the piece by Jared Byrne I was just showing you ago would be one of the projects I've written about where I think the questions of autonomization of form, the liberation of the servants, the cutting up and freeing within a project of form becomes very, very crucially important. Brecht's interlocutor, Benjamin, one of the texts that's most important to me when I wrote this book was what's called Benjamin's Small History of Photography. And what I wanted to remember about that text today, in the short remarks that I'm making, it's written, published in 1931. And in it, Benjamin's making references, as he retells the history of photography over the first century of its existence, to the crash of 1929. There is a text, I actually think, that has a kind of purchase on a moment of deep financial crisis and what images, not just how they react or how they could be said to react to that, but what they do with a moment of social historical crisis. His answer at that point was they reconnect underground, is the phrase he uses, to an earlier history before a kind of economic development happens. So Benjamin in that text famously in 1931, he is connecting the avant-garde of his time. He's thinking of photographers like August Sander in Germany, reconnecting in terms of formal language to a moment before the social historical buildup of industrial capitalism. So the first decade of photography's history is what Benjamin returns to. We see Zoe Leonard doing something, I think, that could be described similarly in the present moment, reconnecting with Walker Evans, reconnecting with Auger, reconnecting also, though, with the social historical forms that have been bypassed in the intervening decades. And can I have the next image? Along with Zoe Leonard, this is why I'm showing these artists here is because in a sense, I've been working, and I will continue to work on a project that I'm calling Lateness and Longing. It's an essay I've written for the Torino Triennial that's not been published yet, but that I hope to make into a book, a short format book, somewhat like this, where I treat both Zoe Leonard and Sharon Lockhart and some other artists' work. I think that move that Benjamin describes vis-a-vis images and crisis, financial crisis, looks something like this right now. I'm showing you a still from Sharon Lockhart's Pine Flat. And I probably won't say anything more about it, though, and stop at this point so we can move on to a discussion.
Okay. My next question, I think, is going to be actually for Morgan, so I'll wait till he's...
Oh, God, I'm sorry, I'm Morgan. You know, when I can't see an audience, you also cut off your ability to self-censor and all.
Okay, this is really interesting. And again, I think back to this idea of emptiness or lack or the lack of an image, and whether that image would, or that lack, rather, would result from destruction and collapse. Or in the case of Morgan's work, I think it's interesting because, I mean, there are, you could address two different ways that you work, Morgan. I think in a film like Parentheses, it reflects the way you've worked all along, which is your work is constructed quite often by rules or through constraints. And I think somebody recently quoted, said that any constraint can become a protagonist in your work. But you had mentioned when we were talking earlier today that in, you know, Parentheses, you know, these images, the insert shots are somehow meaningless, almost to the point of being blank, even if there is some kind of a representation inherent, but that the system in which they are inserted or reinserted both frees them, but, you know, I mean, liberates them from a previous meaning. So maybe that's not destruction per se, but can we talk about constraints and control as well as destruction in terms of producing a lack or a void or a collapse?
I think I understand. One of the things that's been consistent in my work has been to look for ways to shed the responsibilities of being an author, and this has been we can call this desubjectivization, or we can also talk about things like the paradigm of the non-compositional or the anti-compositional. And so...
Can I butt in?
Yeah,
please. Do you not reveal the hidden law?
It's totally unimportant. It's not as if it's the secret meaning. I only needed it to make the film, I would say, for me. I mean, I'm interested in someone like Saul LeWitt, obviously. And I mean, in LeWitt, the rule is absolutely clear. The rule makes the work. We can figure out what the rule is from the work. There's a kind of reciprocity that work proposes. And, of course, it's as if he has stepped out of it so that what we see is a kind of circularity between the rule and the... And its result, as if it came from nowhere, but, of course, it had to come from him. So, ultimately, there has to be an author, even if a lot of the work is about trying to get rid of what we take to be the privileges and responsibilities of authorship as this word, as the expression of sensibility, as these ideas are conventionally understood. And in the case of Parentheses, what I tried to stress in my introductory remark was the idea that in narrative films, inserts are so instrumentalized that all they are is what they are a shot of, and you have a hard time seeing them as anything other than pure, what's the word, meaning. And I was interested in I've always thought that inserts were very, very beautiful. And, of course, the rule is in narrative films is that you never notice the means by which the story or your experience of the film is conveyed. You don't see the cuts, for example. You don't see what the cuts. You don't see the cuts as cuts. You don't see the shots as shots. You only see the cuts and you only see what the shots and the cuts do. So that narrative films try to efface their own syntax and their own modalities, and just to leave you with this emotional experience that is why we go to the movies. And I was interested in letting inserts just be these events that you were free to experience and enjoy. They each have their own meaning, I think. I think that's the nature of images, that we take them to, that we can only take them as having signifying power, even if it's not what's intended. So that happens, and then furthermore, the juxtapositions produce more signifying events, but those events are not intentional. Have I addressed your concerns?
Yeah, but then to move on to the other film, Standard Gauge, which unfortunately we're not able to show today, but in Standard Gauge you take fragments of film strips and then gradually run them over a light box, and then you weave it into what is essentially an essay film, which I'd like to get onto with Hito, and again this idea of both authorship and the essay form within filmmaking. But before I get onto that, I just, vis-a-vis George's comment about destruction, I think the segment in Standard Gauge where you have a fragment about the Hindenburg blimp, and you've spoken quite eloquently about this idea of death and destruction again within the fragmentary image, which I think ties in perhaps really in an interesting way with what George is talking about, although it's a very different system than what Paul Chan is doing, for instance. But I don't know, maybe if you could just first address maybe that idea again of the destruction and how it might relate to the fragmentation of the image, and then I'd like to get on to the essay form question.
Fine. Standard Gauge is a very conservative film, comparatively speaking, and it's a biography. And I used to work as an editor, or I had worked for a while as an editor in the motion picture industry in Los Angeles, and I had collected pieces of film, and so I showed them. And so I showed them in chronological order, and I talked about them. And so it's a little bit about me. It's a little bit about the history of film. It's very digressive. The shots give me a chance to talk about these fragments, give me a chance to talk about other things. And in response to Stuart's remarks, other people have remarked on this idea that that the film is haunted by a sense of death. And I think it might be for two reasons. One is, there seem to be lots of, like, express allusions to death. For example, I talk about a shot in Bruce Conner's film, A Movie, which is a scene of an execution in the aftermath of the Second World War, where Pietro Caruso, who was the Questore di Roma, was executed after the war. There's an old piece of newsreel of the Hindenburg, which later on went up in a catastrophic and apocalyptic explosion and fire and killed people. And then this piece of film is on nitrate, which is something that dies. And so the idea of destruction is rehearsed in various ways. But finally, I would just say this, and that is the film, the Standard Gauge is a one-take film. It's 32 minutes long. And I think that being shot in real, you lose sight of this because you see one piece after another. So it looks like a series of shots, but in fact it's in real time. And I think that I came to realize this only very recently, that perhaps it being in real time is also somehow in a more allegorical way about death, because real time is what we live in. There is no montage in human lives.
Unfortunately,
yes. Right.
When I call you,
Anthony. In a way, though, I mean, you are talking about the specificity of film. I mean, that is what standard gauge is very much about. It is about the standard gauge of 35-millimeter film, just as Hito is addressing the specificity of video in her work to a certain extent. But I am interested, I suppose, you know, again, just getting back to this idea of the authorial, or the way you've both constructed these images through a kind of essay form, and the way you insert your own voice into this, so the way the images are then led along, as it were.
Is that what you mean by an essay of voiceover?
Yes. But there's...
Not precisely. But maybe I'd like to respond to what you just said, that human lives are not montaged. I think I'd like to strongly disagree on that.
That human life is not montage.
Yes. Yeah. I think human life is essentially montage, you know. It's a jumble of time fragments which are sort of combined and pulled apart. And in that sense, it's like a zapping spree. That's human life, I think, contemporary human life. That's what it is. It is a montage, essentially. And this is also a point which relates to the form of the essay as such. Because I think the form of essay, I mean, I've been doing essay films throughout... since I started filmmaking, basically. But lately, I've come to reconsider this form, also in the light of the recent economic shifts that you've been also addressing, because I think that the hope that people had invested into the form of essay, that it would be a form which would essentially disrupt, you know, dominant forms of temporality, essentially, which were based on repetition, the drab work on the conveyor belt, the routines of the factory, the coerced identity produced within these factories, that, let's say, the jumbo, you know, and the weird combinations that the essay produces would be able to disrupt this type of temporality. But essentially, as I said, I think that nowadays we're living in a time where not only our own personal life, but also production as such is very much predicated on the assembling, on the montage of heterogeneous fragments of almost everything. I mean, the global production, modes of production are absolutely based on this principle of the assembling of the different. And that's the same principle in which, let's say, flexibilized time schedules are being montaged in a way. So I think, what does the form of essay mean nowadays? What does the essay as form mean nowadays? Has it turned into something which could be dubbed an essay as conformism, as going along, you know, with the dominant modes of production, with the dominant modes of the attention economy, with the types of attention we are being forced into by the mass media constantly. So in that sense, I'm not really sure what the form of essay is doing at the moment, but in a way, there could be an alternative way to think through the essay again if we are not considering it as essentially articulating images to each other, or voices and images and sounds to each other, but in a way really constructing relations of people or social relations, because in the present moment, the practical work in an essay film really relates people to each other, people who are passing on images, people who are distributing images, people who are viewing images, reviewing images, appropriating images, adapting images, you know, changing them. And I think it's very, I started to shift my attention to the sort of social relations that this essayistic form of production is actually creating. Who am I being connected to by working in this type of digital essay filmmaking? Who am I getting my images from? Who is viewing, you know, the things I produce? I think if one tries to re-articulate the form of essay in focusing on the social relations and technological relations, political relations, whatever sort of relations, then it might be again possible, you know, to transform it or into something which is activating instead of creating passive audiences.
So if I hear you right, you're saying
The essay film is a biographical form that you want to shift into a social form?
No, I mean, it's never been a biographical form as such. I think the essay was always about relating, let's say, maybe personal experiences to larger frameworks.
That's what I meant.
Yes, absolutely.
In that sense, Morgan's. I'm obviously thinking of Anthony McCall, sorry, in my mind. Morgan's Standard Gauge. I mean, it's a strange set of self-reflections if you're looking at other films. And the self-reflection of the editor is also a strange authorial position to expound upon from the sight of the personal. You know, it's not necessarily in the hierarchy of authorship functions, the one that had been at the top. So.
I'm just trying to find a way to. I'll just stress this about Standard Gauge. It's a one take film within which there are a series of discontinuities or fragments that have nothing to do with each other except that they're linked by the chronological. They're being in chronological order in relation to the life of the person who, you know, found and saved these fragments and then wrote about them. So, I mean, I was taking a very, like, literalist view of what a life is. I mean, I'll just say it. I'll say it again. If this gives Hito another chance to disagree with me, I'm happy to do it. Life is a one-take film. I mean, it's kind of discouraging, actually, to think about it. And, yeah, it's a long, you know. So it's one take. It is time without interruption. But then, of course, in your experience of it, it's very different. And then you have memory of your earlier experiences and so on. But in its literality, as to what it constitutes as an event with respect to time, it's a one-take film.
Yes, I agree. But it's a one-take film in which people continuously rehearse and reenact roles which they have picked up from other films. So in that sense, yes.
But even that one take and Standard Gauge is comprised of quite a few fragments.
Which people take to be shots, when in fact they're not. They're just episodes within one take.
Maybe Hito, I mean, again, you've written a bit previously, and I should also mention that Hito is a writer as well as a filmmaker and artist, but about this idea of representation, not just in sense of the image, but in terms of political representation as well. And I think, you know, what you've just said a few minutes ago alludes to these connections you're trying to make, I think, between the way images can or do function now and what political currency that might engender. So maybe you could elaborate a little bit on that.
I was trying to think through representations while thinking about abstract images.
Yes.
What does abstraction mean with respect to representation, specifically political representation? Is the what I was talking about earlier on, the increasing abstraction of documentary images, does it refer to an end or an impasse or a deadlock of representation which takes place on many different levels, maybe? In terms of political representation, I think this impasse is pretty obvious. The political frameworks in which we are living, let's say the nation states, are hardly any more functional for really negotiating our political reality. We are living in strange, you know, post or para-democratic hybrids such as the European Union, where democratic representation becomes a huge mess. You know, it can't be really called some form of traditional political representation anymore. We are also living in times where many people are not anymore politically represented at all. So does this emerging trend to abstraction in the mass media, does it refer or hint to that, or does it sort of condense this tendency or the problem of contemporary political representation? This was one of the questions I have been asking. And in that way, I mean, this can be maybe be described as a sort of symptom of a crisis, but on the other hand, what sort of images or of image production could one imagine that would recreate political relations between people, you know, who are not set inside the same political realm of representation? What sorts of constituencies could be imagined, audiences, or as I like to call them, peer groups, you know, which share certain, you know, databases or which circulate certain images among them? So these might also be new forms of political representations which have not yet emerged. I mean, it might be slightly optimistic even to think that they could be emerging, but there is at least that possibility.
And how might that tie in, George, to your idea about an aesthetics of collapse?
Well, I don't know. I mean, when you said this crisis of political representation, I mean, I was interested in the example that falls out of representation. Like, are you thinking of refugees, or I mean, you said the notion that's important to you is that there are those who are not even represented, politically speaking.
For example, but in a way, you could also think about, I mean, how do you represent this whole financial crisis in a political framework? It's sort of irrepresentable or hardly representable. I mean, there's no political framework to deal with this crisis. So it's not only about refugees and so on. There are actually many very important events which are not representable in a political framework anymore.
So, I mean, this is the essential problem that, I mean, I've been trying to think through a bit is, you know, I mean, what was representable and what was abstract at the moment of modernism was related to quite specific historical conditions. I mean, capital at that moment was based on a product, and it was, you know, it was corn money or it was like wheat money. I mean, so what happens when you have money, like when it's not art for art's sake, but money for money's sake? That's finance capital. So what's abstract at that point? I mean, representational images are potentially abstract, and I think, as Hito's been trying to point out, abstractions in such a moment become potentially deeply concrete. I mean, they're potentially referring to, in the almost old-fashioned sense that we use that term, to a referent, to a quite specific historical social condition. Now, what it means when that condition collapses, that's what I don't know yet. I don't know what that will look like, and I don't know that, I mean, how can an artist work with such a such an incredible moment of opportunity as the current moment actually
This is the key question. I mean, going back to Mark Godfrey's book about the Holocaust, I mean, you know, he very much addresses that idea of, you know, how did artists cope with that kind of a disaster, you know, and at a certain point they did turn to a notion of abstraction that's now shifting into another kind of abstraction. And in a way, again, I guess maybe this brings us onto this idea of the monochrome that functions in both of your work, although I think in potentially very different ways. But, I mean, maybe, Hito, you could talk about Red Alert, which is based on Rodchenko. But, again, if Rodchenko, you know, creates a monochrome at that moment in time, in 1921, mm-hmm. you know, how does your positioning a monochrome in 2007?
I'm not going to be able to, you know, connect all these questions.
Can I ask Morgan about abstraction?
Yeah.
But Stuart asked Hito first.
I'm sorry. I thought you said no.
No.
I was trying to help.
Okay. No, I can talk about Red Alert briefly. It's actually a video monochrome triptych, if you like, which consists of three computer screens, which are hung vertically. And in fact, it's an almost, it's an exact as possible replica of a series of monochromes which Alexander Rodchenko had been doing in 1921. They were called Pure Blue, Pure Yellow, and Pure Red. And in this series, he thought that he had reached the end of leftist painting. He said, that's the end. There is no way to go any further. Leftist painting is over. And now we have to move into something different. And I sort of tried to make a new media translation of this triptych, but I used only one color instead of three primary colors, which is the color orange used by the Homeland Security Office, U.S. Homeland Security Office, for their highest terror alert to indicate maybe that this is the prime, or this was perhaps the primary color of that moment, of that era, that there was only one color left, namely that orange, which was tinting and penetrating perception at this point above anything else. And this also raised the question again for me, does this indicate a moment where, let's say, documentary representation has reached some end or some limit or some border, which is similar to the end of painting that Rodchenko proclaimed in 1921. What does it mean? I mean, we are in a state where we don't believe any sort of documentary image anymore. The distrust is so deeply ingrained that one could say that this has really been become the core characteristic of documentary images. This is the distrust, you know, that they evoke. So what does it mean then? If we don't believe them, is this the end of documentary representation as such? Have we already reached such a limit? These were the questions which I thought, which I was thinking through while I was making this work.
And Morgan, I know you were dying to talk about the rectangle, so maybe you could.
I saw Red Alert, a documentary, and I just loved it. And I'll try to be brief. Hito was very careful to say that she tried to reproduce as closely as possible Rodchenko's triptych. Now, the fact of the matter is that film and video are industrial forms. That is to say that they follow standards and formats that Hito and I did not have much to say about. Other people made those decisions. They made the decision film. Someone else decided the gauge. They decided the aspect ratio. And when you make a film, you very seldom work with the questions of image size on the screen because you don't control it. So it's not yours to control, but except in very rare circumstances. And so what this means is you have to work within the constraints that other people have given you. And, of course, these images are always rectangular. This is the condition of a picture, most pictures. Not from the beginning, but the last couple of centuries. Either that or also very simple geometrical form. For example, Jeff Wall has made circular pictures. And the very first Eastman Kodak box camera made circular pictures. But anyway, a simple geometrical form was always a rectangle. And so as much as you wanted to reenact Rodchenko, it couldn't be the exact size and shape because it wasn't within your power to make a video image that could do that. And it took me... I was always interested in painting, but when I started doing painting, it took me a while to realize. I mean, I realized it without articulating it to myself, that this was something I could work with. Whereas in film and video too, I would say you are, so to speak, stuck with a rectangle. In painting, you're not. And you can make it a shape other than a rectangle. And I think in painting, this is particularly important to do because, as I say, and I mean this to be polemical, if it's a rectangle, it's a picture in painting, even if it's an abstract painting. It's still a picture, and that would be my way of talking about the difficulty of doing abstraction today, is that abstraction as we encounter it is already, so to speak, turned into a picture by virtue of it being within a rectangle. So one of the things I've pursued in painting, well, it's two paths. One is they're not rectangular, and the size means something because I can control the size. So the things I couldn't control in film, it being a rectangle and having no control over the size, I can control in painting, and I work with that as something that actually produces signification. That's one way to do it. And then if the paintings are, sometimes they're rectangular, and they are made in relation to architecture. So it's the architecture that's doing the composing and also the placing. So among other things, the paintings, because they require to be located in certain ways in relation to the architecture, act against the idea of a painting as a commodity that's totally under the control of people into whose hands it passes after it leaves the studio. for example, collectors, for example, curators. No, you can't put that wherever you want. The condition of this painting is that it has to go here. So it acts to obstruct the kind of latitude and license that the curators take as something that goes without saying. And the paintings are all monochromes because I wouldn't know what to make a picture of, and I'm not interested in pictures. I'm interested in interrogating this very, all the things that go without, that tend to go without saying about painting as this portable object, which is also, you know, ready to enter the market and the circulation of objects within the market.
I find it, I mean, really fascinating to, if I understand, if I'm not going to falsely restate what you just said, that you found some of the constrictions of filmmaking made moving into painting attractive and vice versa, how you paint is informed by the filmmaking practice that you've been involved
exactly,
in.
But it's a relation of
inversion and
of inversion. Yeah, I didn't realize this when I started painting. I think, oh, and then, yeah.
So, Hito, I was struck by the fact that you're working in video, but you're film. You know, you're reworking your older film works in the clip you showed. Has that been a way in which that you work as well, or not as important between different media? I'm wondering if that relates to this larger sort of philosophical project you've been laying out.
Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, because I work a lot with found footage, I always end up combining a lot of low-resolution versions of, you know, a lot of different media, which pass through a process of being degraded before ending up in my film. So I'm very interested in reconstructing these processes on various levels. And these, again, have to do, in many cases, with the changing frameworks of political representation. Just one example, I was once following the path of one specific 35mm widescreen frame before it ended up, or didn't even end up, in one of my films, which came from the Sarajevo Film Museum, which is a national film archive. So how did it end up in a completely degraded VHS form in my film? And this has a lot to do with the violent dissolution of the archive itself, of the state, which helped maintain it and construct it, and so on. So this is not, I mean, of course, it reflects in media, but there are political and economical conditions which are impacting on images and their conditions. So in that case, the picture ended up being completely cropped so that you could see only half of it, basically. Both sides were cut off. And then the image metamorphosed like a lot more times before it eventually ended up in my films. But I'm very interested in retracing all these steps of transformations and the political influences, you know, on images.
I wonder if we could just return as well to what you mentioned earlier, just about the degraded image or a kind of hierarchy of resolution, which I think is really interesting. And I think, again, it bears to some extent on Morgan's parentheses in terms of, you know, again, liberating something from its hierarchy in some way. But, I mean, we spoke earlier this morning about that moment during the bus bombings in London a few years ago when suddenly every major newspaper in the world on the front page had a cell phone photograph. And then, you know, the way those kinds of images are circulating now are quite commonplace, but it's still a relatively, you know, recent phenomenon. But in terms of, I mean, how these image hierarchies work and how you might construct systems within your own work to, you know, free them or give them a different kind of role, I wonder if maybe you could both elaborate on that a little bit. Because I think, you know, you're both constructing systems to liberate images, and I think they're different kinds of systems. But in a sense, I think it's an interesting problem.
Well, I was thinking when you were talking about the constraints of the rectangular frame and the necessity of, you know, liberating images from this frame, I think in a way this happens and does not happen again with digital images as well, but they not in a visible form. I mean, this leaking from the frame is taking place with these type of images. You are talking about these cell phone digital degraded images between one, let's say, a station to the next. You know, in the ways of communication, these images are sort of liquid. they are leaking, they are exceeding their, let's say, official framework of circulation. In this way, they are transgressing the frame, although it never becomes visible, you know. At the point where you intercept them, where they become visible, they become rectangular again. But their way of moving between the screens, if you like, is very fluid and exceeds, you know, the standards, the dominant standards of circulation.
One of the, I was happy that in parentheses it's very clear that each one of these fragments, and of course you probably realize that sometimes there's more than one shot from the same film, that there are all these different, some shots are in better condition than others. The color is better, there are fewer scratches, so that one senses that there's even if there's a kind of equality, oh, this, there's a kind of equality among the shots in that they're all sort of present to each other and present to us in within the space of the same film. Each shot or each grouping of shots from the same film has its own history, and those histories are very, very different. I mean, some of these prints have, so to speak, suffered and had unhappy histories because they're faded, they're scratched, the color has shifted radically, or the color has gone altogether. Later on in the film, there's a case where there's a scratch, and then at the cut, the scratch disappears, and then So there's a sense of disjunction and difference in the histories that each one of these shots or groupings of shots bring. And I should just to go back to say something. I wanted to be clear about this. I thought of the film in terms of units. This is related to this idea of equality. So in a sense, it's like a grid in that every cell in a grid is equal with every other cell, and there's no sense of hierarchy. And so it is a film of units, literally. They're different lengths, and they show different things. But in my constructing the film, it's a film of absolutely equal units, as if it were a grid. Just to go back.
Which seems an idea linked to painting or pictures itself. I mean, that seemed to be also a kind of self-reference in the film. I mean, shots of Western movies, gunshots, shots of scissors before cuts, and
why don't I think of things like that?
I'm sure you do think of things like that. But I mean, so it seemed like there's a certain hope placed again in ideas of self-reference when we least expect it, an abstraction. And the terms you're using, like the grid, are from that language.
I'm so happy that those things are there for other people to find, because I didn't put them there. I mean, chance can do wonderful, wonderful things. I'll just very quickly, I've stressed this idea of trying to be like anti-authorial at the same time that I want to make a work, which is a paradoxical situation to be in, but I did have to make choices about what shots to include, which made me very unhappy, but I had to. But I'm glad that there are some shots that I will call weak or particularly uninteresting or inscrutable, or because I think it throws emphasis on this idea of the formal construction that underlies it. And my way of explaining the interest in the weak shots is that in poetry, we all know, especially in old-fashioned poetry, in verse, there you have to get rid of syllables to make the scan work out, or you have to add syllables to make the scan work out. So that's one of the ways that I think of the weak shots, is it's a way of pointing to the fact that underneath it all, the film is about the distribution of quantities, in much in the same way that old-fashioned versification is about the distribution of quantities.
I want to ask Morgan one last question, and then I think we only have a few minutes left, so we should probably open it up to one or two questions. But maybe, again, going back to your interest in Saul LeWitt and the idea that anyone could make this film, which is true of a couple of your other films, such as Screening Room, and probably a few more. But maybe, I mean, it brings up some issues about ownership and, again, authorship. Maybe you could just elaborate a little bit on that and, you know, again, how the image might function within that economy.
I made a film in 1968 called Screening Room, which is a tracking shot into the theater where you're sitting watching the film. So obviously it has to be remade for each new theater. And there are at least two versions of this film. The word I prefer to version is state. There are two states of this film. There's one state of this film that I've never seen. I simply told them how it should be done. It should terminate in the screening room with the light on and the projector, and then there's a zoom into the. So all the films look different. All the different states look different from each other, but they're all the same film. And there was one. Yeah, there's one version I've never seen. And this is true also of at least one painting. I made a painting that I've never seen. And I think that that's a good way to synopsize exactly what the problem, if I can put it that way, of authorship is, and at the same time, various solutions for how, or that in fact it is possible to overcome it, the idea of authorship as it's conventionally conceived. I don't think I'm answering your question, Stuart, but I don't
You're
know quite
that.
How to. So I think that's what I'll. I mean, the fact is, I am proprietary. It's my painting, even though I've never made it, even though I've never seen it. I didn't make it. I've never seen it, but it's my work. And the same with Screening Room. It's my work. But I'm interested in models where there can be a kind of generosity about the actual making and the decisions that go into the making, so that it doesn't insist on anything like a residue of the expressive gesture and the connection with the body that comes from painting, and that in film is carried over into the idea of, like, well, most obviously, in, for example, the handheld camera, which is a kind of hyperbolic instance of that. That doesn't interest me. And in general, my films tend to follow the model of copy photography, which is a very impersonal mode and an entirely conventionalized one.
Okay, I think we probably have time for one question, maybe two, if anybody has one. There's someone in the back. Okay.
There's two comments or questions, which maybe are for Hito and George. One, which was, I was really interested in, sorry, where are my notes, what was said about the core character of the documentary is now distrust. I thought, if that's a kind of zenith point, what does that then mean? I wondered if there was more to say about that. And then the other point was really about the aesthetics of collapse. And this kind of this idea of free-flowing, circulating images and is in part come out of obviously technological development and the sort of excesses of capital flows. And I was wondering what happens now at this point of arrest of those flows. And I mean, in a way, that's more of a difficult question because it's what we're all wondering about now. But so two things, really. One, if there was anything more to say about the core character of documentary becoming distrust or things becoming utterly corrupt. And then the other was something more reflexive about where do we go. I don't know if Hito or George.
Oh, I'm not sure I can answer the first part of the question about documentary and distrust, although... That's Hito tells me not to worry, so I won't. But in terms of the second part, I would think of it, you know, the current situation for me is ghosted and shadowed by the examples of modernism. So in this case of your question again, you know, I think of something like in the moment of modernism, one of the specters haunting modernist practice was something like the mass media in its earlier forms, newspapers, and the kind of surfeit of information / communication, giving rise to an aesthetics of anti-communication or opacity in some sense. So is there an equivalent in the current moment of this moment of what you've called flow, the flow of information, the flow of capital, and when that freezes, what are the possibilities? Now, that's a question that I can't exactly answer, but it's already seemed clear to me that one way of describing opacity in contemporary art is not that it's not the same as modernist opacity. It's not going back to abstraction again in the same sense. It's about rupture, breaking flows, closing down on the spread and free flow of communication already before a current moment of something like a financial crisis. But it's already a moment, a kind of description of what's happening in certain contemporary projects that might contain recipes for practice in the present, like right now. So, I guess I'm just trying to say I have new hopes for opacity, if that makes sense, and doesn't make me sound like I'm talking about Mallarmé and Malevich again. I think these examples, however, have much more to say to us as we update them in the contemporary moment. So yeah, I'm back to abstraction.
There could be a much more dire possibility, though. I mean, if you just think of translating terms like renationalization onto the realm of images or art histories or the circulation of images as such, you know, that's also a very real possibility that might happen at this point. But to come back to your question about the distrust, which, to my opinion, is sort of already inherent in the spectator's expectation in documentary images, I think it's sort of obvious because media literacy is so high now after a 20th century which was filled with, you know, misinformation, propaganda, and so on. So I think, you know, distrust is no more the exception, it's the rule if anybody watches documentary images. And, I mean, there are, of course, many consequences or ramifications starting from there, but just to mention one, I think that maybe one should shift the perspective a bit and think about documentary images not primarily concerning information or conveying facts or something like that, but in telling us something about our own system of beliefs. I have recently become interested in linking Guattari's notion of a theocratical regime of images with the documentary format, because the realm of documentary is rather about our belief in them, you know, and also this belief is totally troubled because there's this lot of distrust around these images. But why do we still believe them, or why do we have to believe them, although we know that they might not be accurate, correct, and so on? So I think that's an, for me, this will be an important direction in which to rethink the relation of the documentary and the spectator. Why do we believe?
One last question, and then I think we'll have to close it up.
I think maybe just a little bit.
Sharon. She's got a mic, Sharon, yeah.
I think, Hito, this may speak a little to where you just were, but also back to what came up several times throughout your discussion. I spend a lot of time working and looking at the work of 20, 21-year-old media makers, video filmmakers, and there's two things that I feel like I have a lot to learn from them about questions of resolution, in particular, and the hierarchy of resolution that you were talking about, Hito, and also about this kind of equality of images, Morgan, that you were pointing to in parentheses, because for them, they will pull from anywhere. And all of those images, in some ways, are democratized within a narrative. So they don't think of a low-res image and a high-res image at this point or at certain points in a different relation. And they'll use whatever they need to use to communicate the kind of piece. So it's, I guess what strikes me, or what I wanted to maybe point to and ask for your comment on, is that there are, in some ways, two hierarchies, because we're still in an economic hierarchy of resolution. Cameras that can shoot at high resolution are still more expensive than cameras that can shoot at low resolution, et cetera. But I also think there's another economy. I guess I wanted to speak a little to this idea that the way in which images flow across the internet is not solely freedom, because the internet is producing and the distribution of those images are functioning under another economy where hits, the number of times that an image is seen or the number of times that a website with an image is visited, is not only valuable but has value. And also that this kind of Google and Apple entrance into cell phone technology, that each text message, each communication, which sometimes will only be an image, also has value. And I guess what strikes me a little bit is to ask, I think in certain of those cases, an image is not traveling, and this is maybe what you were just getting to, an image is not traveling precisely because of its imageness, but for some other reason, as a marker or a placeholder or an event or a communication, a literal quote-unquote message.
Put on the mic, please. I think that this might also relate to this moment of financial speculation and of crash, you know, these viral hypes, images distributing at, you know, tremendous speed online. This is maybe it expresses the same type of dynamics as, you know, stock market crashes, for example, or booms, on the other hand.
I mean, the other side of financial speculation is what is discarded. I mean, jobs, I mean, products themselves, people get, you know, companies getting rid of their productive sectors. And so sort of along with financial speculation, you have a kind of economics of the discard. And I think that applies as much to images, too. I mean, this kind of dumping of images, the garbage image is something to theorize and consider today. The image as garbage. And maybe that's also a productive place for aesthetic practice, too. I don't know.
Well, I'm afraid I think they need to discard us from this room now. So thank you very, very much, Hito, Morgan, and George, and again to Fries for having us here today.